I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Winston Churchill once said in his own review of American power that you can always rely on America to do the right thing once it has exhausted all the other alternatives. It's a favorite line of Bill Emmett's. He's editor-in-chief of The Economist magazine. He and his team of writers have used a lot of ink in recent months trying to make sense of American power and where its use or abuse is leading the rest of the world. Katrina VandenHeuvel and her writers are engaged in exactly the same exercise, reporting on the exercise of U.S. power. But Ms. VandenHeuvel, as editor of The Nation magazine, is much more likely to be caught quoting someone like Emma Goldman, who said 101 years ago that we shall soon be obliged to meet in cellars or in darkened rooms with closed doors and speak in whispers lest our next-door neighbors should hear that freeborn citizens dare not speak in the open. And so today, Connection listeners, a conversation in the open about American power. And here's the question. When it comes to America's foreign policy, does the end justify the means? Saddam Hussein is gone, and for the first time in a long time, people are at least talking about peace in the Middle East. So does it matter what tools the U.S. used to get to this point? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Bill Emmett, editor of The Economist, joins us from a studio in London. Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor of The Nation, is joining us from New York. Welcome to both of you.
Good to be with you.
Bill, let me start with you. This whole ideological puzzle about the ends justifying the means has to, of course, start with definitions. What is the end? What is the means? Let me use the meeting this week of Bush, Sharon, and Abbas as a moment, perhaps an encouraging moment. But where does this fit in the continuum of ends justifying means?
Well, for a start, we don't know where the end is. So we have to judge that meeting with some caution. I think some excitement. I think it's an incredibly good thing that the meeting happened. I think that many things were said on both sides which were encouraging. I also think that the things that were said and the meeting itself probably would not have happened if it hadn't been for the war in Iraq, or rather for the removal of the regime of Saddam Hussein. The combination of the disappearance of that regime and the clear expression of American power in the region were an essential background to this meeting taking place. But we don't know where it's going to lead. We have to hope that it leads to a peaceful settlement in the Middle East between the two sides and the construction of two states, both of them with either continuous or contiguous territories, to use President Bush's slightly mixed up phrase. But we cannot presume the outcome at this stage.
And Katrina, so how do you then weigh in as a journalist trying to figure out if ends justify the means? You talked to me about the meeting this week and whether or not it caused you, even for a nanosecond, to go, maybe casts a better light on what happened in Iraq.
Well, I think the hope is that coming out of Iraq, and I disagree with Bill Emmett that it was that war that has pushed the United States to this point, I think it will be a test case, what is going to go on in mapping a Middle East peace, as to whether this administration has any willingness to abide by international law and work constructively with multilateral institutions. That is crucial to ensuring that this roadmap, which has pitfalls, obviously, but this roadmap, which is the construct of the European Union, the United Nations, and Russia, three institutions, one country, which were dissed, so to speak, in the process of run-up to war. If those institutions will work together with a very dominant United States, which has a record in the Middle East of a failed power in many ways, not a benevolent power, and this is an administration that has flouted world opinion and, as I said, international law in prosecuting a preemptive war. So, as Bill Emmett said, we will need to see. I think one key point to make is one that is sometimes ignored, and this goes to the facts on the ground, so to speak. It does no favor to Israel for the quartet not to pressure Ariel Sharon into fully committing to the roadmap and eventual withdrawal of the settlements from the occupied territory, something that Ariel Sharon is not committing to at this stage, but I guess there's pressure on all sides, on both sides in the Middle East, to speak to some sense of progress.
But Bill Emmett, neither the UN nor the EU nor Russia was in that photo op underneath the palm trees. Is that what you're using to say that the U.S. willingness to use strength power in Iraq is what brought George Bush to that particular moment?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I mean, I'd say two things. One is that I don't understand why Katrina said that the roadmap came from three of the quartet and not the fourth. The roadmap came from all four, including the United States. But the second thing I would say is that the limit to multilateralism in this area is that everyone expects the United States to lead. Everyone expects the United States to sort out the Middle East. That's why George Bush was there with King Abdullah of Jordan and Ariel Sharon and Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinians, and why the others weren't there. It's because America is seen to be the leading power in the world and the one up front, the one that is expected to both carry burdens, bear prices, and indeed take the brickbats. It is unavoidably and ineluctably absolutely in the forefront.
Katrina, why are you saying that the hardball tactics in Iraq did not lead to that moment? Why don't you make that connection?
Well, I think that this peace process, so to speak, in the Middle East has stood apart from what the war in Iraq, and that I think in it's too early to tell, but it may well be that the war in Iraq will pose more problems for resolution of the Middle East crisis. And maybe we'll see more destabilization of the region, because I have to say I am pessimistic in light of this administration's history so far in terms of the Middle East crisis. I agree with Bill Emmett that when I say the quartet, the United States has to be a factor in it. And the other powers in the quartet need to put pressure on the United States to pursue a fair and just intervention in the region. But foreign policy cannot be set apart from domestic policy. And as we look at the United States today and the lock on the Bush administration of a domestic situation in which the far right of the Israeli political community, the Likud party, has a grip on the leadership of the American Jewish community, and then you have the Christian evangelicals aligning with that bloc, it seems very difficult to think that there will be progress in anticipation of the 2004 election in this country. So in light of both this administration's violation of international law, its contempt for multilateralism, and the domestic problems regarding the Middle East peace process, I'm not optimistic.
Bill Emmett, is the American administration, in your view, a captive to special interest groups or acting on its own here?
I think, like all administrations, it is influenced by special interest groups, just as people used to say during the Clinton administration that the so-called Jewish lobby had a lock on the Clinton administration, that it biased what it did, that Democratic votes depended on it. And this explained why it did not, in fact, do very much to solve the problems in the Middle East until Bill Clinton no longer needed to run for election and tried to rush a solution to the Middle East in his last few months in office, and therefore didn't leave enough time. Of course, special interests influence all administrations, as they do all democratic politics in the United States, and I believe their influence is excessive and needs to be reduced. But I don't think it's right to presume that these interests will block the outcome that we hope for. My optimism is based on the fact that really George Bush's interests, electorally in 2004, in history, in terms of his legacy as a president, whether as a one-term or a two-term president, is absolutely and clearly bound up in improving things in the Middle East. The Middle East hit him incredibly hard on September the 11th, but also defined his presidency. He has taken a bold leadership position in going alone, just with Britain and Australia, in Iraq, and seeking to reshape the Middle East and to bring greater peace, prosperity, and democracy to the region. Whether he succeeds or fails in that is, frankly, what we're all going to remember him for. And that's his pressure.
But if I could just add, speaking to the larger issue of American power, it seems to me that, yes, he created this so-called coalition of the willing in order to make the case that it wasn't America alone. But the key to world peace and prosperity, and I think both Bill Emmett and I agree, you know, that America plays is the dominant power in the world today. It's how you use that power. It's how America engages the world. And the key to world peace, security, prosperity, and democracy is not American dominance, but the strengthening of international governance. And I think the overstating of the ability of any one power, even a country as seemingly powerful as the United States, to maintain order in an increasingly complex and interdependent world, it's no more possible to guide a complex international order than it is for central planning to successfully manage an advanced economy. So I think we need to look more carefully at the collective weakness of international community to deal. I mean, let me just conclude that this is an administration that has engaged in a kind of smash-mouth international diplomacy, alienating the very alliances it needs to fight stateless terrorism. Military dominance is not going to meet those challenges in the 21st century. And this administration believes in military dominance as the answer to almost anything.
That's not true.
Go ahead, Bill.
Well, I agree with Katrina that military dominance is not enough. And indeed, I think that actually the role of America's military leadership is going to be seen to be, in historical terms, in decline. I think that military power is of only limited use. But that doesn't mean it's of no use. And I think what this administration has seen correctly, as I think the Clinton administration saw partially before it, is that military power is an essential tool. You have to use it to either respond to an attack or to begin some processes. It is necessary, yes, but it is far from sufficient. On a military level, it's very hard to operate in a multilateral, collective, international community sort of framework. The truth about the history of the United Nations is that the United Nations has only very, very, very rarely been involved in any military action overseas. In either as an approver or as a participant in terms of sending collectively blue-helmeted troops. It's been very rare in history that this has happened, for an obvious reason that command structures and decision-making structures don't lend themselves to it. But what's vital is that on the other dimensions, economic, diplomatic, cultural, social, you do have collective efforts, multilateral efforts, and that's where I think Katrina and I agree. What's vital is that the Bush administration remembers what I think it knows, but it must give higher priority to the other dimensions of multilateralism.
All right. Connection listeners, we're talking about the wise or the not so wise use of American power. A new study out this week says that support for America around the world has plummeted. Still, the Bush administration this week made some progress towards resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. At least there was a meeting. And some say they could only do so after winning the military conflict in Iraq. So how do you feel about the idea that the end may justify the means? And does it matter if America's foreign policy tactics create some hostility along the way? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're talking this hour with Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor of The Nation, Bill Emmett, editor of The Economist, both of whom spend a lot of time thinking about America's role in the world. And they, of course, come up with quite different viewpoints about how American leaders should wield the power that they have. And Connection listeners, what's acceptable for political leaders in the name of democracy and safety? Where do you stand? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I suppose if we change the markers here and say that we're going to measure the ends and the means by putting in rescuing the world from weapons of mass destruction, Katrina, that things look a lot less favorable towards the whatever means were used towards that end.
Well, I think we are now in the process in both countries, in Britain and in the United States, perhaps more so in Britain, which seems to have a more resilient, lively political debate about this as to whether We were led into war on the basis of deceit, of fabricated evidence, hyped intelligence, politicized intelligence about whether Iraq posed an imminent and grave threat to the security of the world and the United States. And I think what is so dangerous here is, and I think this should concern all citizens, left, right, center, up, down, is that if one's government deceives citizens in taking it in towards a violation of the fundamental trust between government and citizen. And I think in this country, an investigation is underway, as it should be. I mean, the selling of the war is arguably the worst scandal in American political history.
You
worse
say it's
than
worse
Watergate.
Than Watergate. Yeah, that seems...
I think it's worse than Watergate. Watergate was an important violation of the constitutional system of our operation of government, worse than Iran-Contra, because it's taking a country into war on the basis of fabricated evidence. And for those, you know, for those who say, well, you know, Saddam was taken out. Yes, Saddam was a murderous tyrant. But, you know, many of the neoconservatives who fomented this war were nonchalant or worse about mass murders in Central America, or were shaking hands with this brutal dictator at a time in 1988 when he was gassing his citizens or the Kurds.
All right, let me, if I can.
I think it's a fundamental violation.
Bill, I want to hear from you on this. Your magazine wonders whether or not the scandal over the selling of the weapons of mass destruction could be the beginning of the end for Prime Minister Blair.
Yes, I mean, I agree with Katrina that if it is found that there was deceit over this issue, then it will be a huge scandal. I personally will be absolutely outraged, and I think that it will be an incredibly reckless and dangerous act to have done that, because it will destroy the credibility of administrations for years to come, just as Watergate did,
right.
And just as actually what I think was a bigger scandal, which was the bombing of Cambodia at a similar time.
But doesn't that then, that one fact alone, change the measure of American power? By saying, yes, and I know we're speculating here, but if in fact the evidence was cocked up on this, then how can you judge American power in any way other than looking at that first?
Well, you see, I think sorry, Bill, I'm sorry.
Oh, yes, thank you, Katrina. Sorry, I was just going to say I think that American power requires some credibility and moral authority, and a lot of it of that comes from the fact that America is a democracy, that the government is held to account by the press and by opposition parties, and therefore that a reasonable amount of honesty and transparency is expected. If that is proven to have not been the case, that will severely diminish American power.
Katrina.
I worry about what we're seeing in terms of the gap between what's going on in Britain and what's going on in America. It seems that in Britain, and correct me if I'm wrong, Bill, that there is more how to put attraction around this issue, that it does seem to be affecting Prime Minister Blair's political standing. In this country, for reasons that we could go into, whether it's the failure of the opposition party in this country, the Democrats, to take up this issue, or the media, which for the most part has followed the White House line for the most part, the polls reflect that Americans don't take this issue seriously, that the ouster of Saddam Hussein was sufficient reasons for going into this war. But, you know, in terms of whether this, yes, I think the issue of American power and its credibility is at stake, which is why I think true conservatives are not running American foreign policy at this point, would want accountability, would want to understand what went wrong in order to not see the credibility gap, not see America's reputation damaged in the world, as it is, because you were citing in a different context polls which show how low America's reputation is in the world today. And that, I believe, was prior to much of the discussion and debate about whether weapons of mass destruction evidence was fabricated.
Yeah, that's right. These are
different polls.
Pew Global Attitudes Project done earlier in this month. Let's if we can bring some of our callers in. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. First to Cambridge now, and Alan's on the line. Hi, Alan.
Hi, how are you? And I'm really enjoying your show, and I'm glad to hear Katrina on the show. I'm a subscriber to The Nation. However, she may not like what I have to say regarding this issue. I feel in this particular case, the end, I think it's abhorrent that maybe lies were perpetrated upon the American public to justify an attack. However, in light of all the mass graves and torture chambers would have been more morally correct not to lie to get the war going and allow, say, 10 million more people to be shot in the back of the head and buried in mass graves while we sit by and wash our hands. Another point I want to make.
Alan, let me just stop. Let me stop you on that, because it's specifically what Katrina was talking about, that attitudes in America are, oh, let's not get hung up on weapons of mass destruction. We now know what we know about Iraq, and in hindsight, the end is justified. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think in this particular case, unfortunately, yes. I think they may find some evidence. I think a smoking gun may never be found. And I don't think that's a good thing for American political and military power to be used that way. However, military power is similar to the sex drive of the male. Use it or lose it. And without American power in the region, I think you would have wholesale anarchy going on everywhere. People are afraid. And it's not a good thing to be militarily minded, but America, you know, on this day, 59 years ago, we had to go to war. And if
Alan, exactly what are you doing with your copies of The Nation? Are you lighting the evening fire? Or?
No, I'm reading it right now, actually. It's a good thing. But, you know, it's just like I'm a libertarian. I'm not a left liberal Democrat or a right Republican.
Yeah.
I just see that you have to read everything to know what's going on. If a person just reads one viewpoint, they're not going to really be able to make an informed decision.
Good on you, Alan. I agree. Katrina, use it or lose it, military power.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to remember that this administration, its justification for going to war and using or abusing the multilateral institution of the United Nations was that Iraq posed an imminent grave threat to the United States and the international community because of its weapons of mass destruction. But putting that aside, I do think the issue of humanitarian intervention is a crucial one. And there are imperfect tools for dealing with humanitarian crises around the world. We see today what's going on in the Congo. We see today what's going on in parts of Africa. Saddam's record of brutality, a very vile and odious one, was more brutal in a decade before we went to war. This was not the justification given to the American people, and I think that's important to recognize. And
we need to grapple
with alternatives for dealing with brutal regimes. Why don't we have an international criminal court that the United States is a signatory to, which would be
but
a
Katrina,
better
that's,
tool?
That's not in place, and this debate might still be underway at the Security Council. What about Alan's point that hindsight has value here in
I don't think in this case. I think we're going to see, and we already see that the Iraqi people are liberated. Yes, but liberated into what at this point? Because part of that speaks to the ends and means, and part of that speaks to the fact that this administration did not have as its intent, as its ends, the liberation of the Iraqi people. There were different intents. According to careful readings of their documents, their plans, their lack of post-war plans, all of that speaks to a failure to consider this in the context of what Alan was speaking about.
Bill.
Well, let me say several things. One is that we have to be sure what we mean when we say whether they lied or not about weapons of mass destruction. If the facts turn out to be more nuanced than some of the headline claims and headline repeats in the press made, I don't think that will constitute a lie or a deceit on the American people. And I do think, with Alan, that it's too soon to judge that. It may well be that things are found. It may well be that evidence of a substantial nature is found. And I think that if it isn't much, then a big question that we'll need to ask is, what on earth was Saddam Hussein doing? Given that by giving up and by proving that he'd given up through complying with Resolution 1441, he could have avoided the war. So I think there's a mystery on both sides. But let's be clear about what we're wanting. I don't think we want to find necessarily a nuclear weapon ticking away somewhere. Second, I think on the intent and intentions of war, the fact is that in a democracy you need a coalition of the willing within the democracy to get support for the war. You needed multiple motivations to get support for the war. The reason why George Bush Sr. didn't finish off Saddam in 1991, the reason why Bill Clinton didn't go to war in 1998 when he did Operation Desert Fox and just a bombing raid, was because he could not get support politically within America to, or indeed the world, to remove Saddam Hussein on purely humanitarian grounds.
But is it about principle or is it about just getting support?
I think it's about getting support, but I think you need to be to tell the truth to get the support, because if you're going to get it the next time, you're going to be tested on what happened before. On, by the way, the situation in Iraq now, I absolutely agree with Katrina that it is chaotic and that the administration has been incompetent in that. I only counsel patience there to wait and see before we make a final judgment. The Marshall Plan after the Second World War didn't take place for more than 2 years after the end of the war. We are less than 2 months after the end of this one.
All right, let's move on if we can. Alan, thank you for that call. To Baton Rouge, Louisiana now. Charles is joining us. Hi, Charles.
How you doing?
Fine, thanks for calling.
I do agree with Katrina's point that the war was based on weapons of mass destruction, and now it's all about, since we can't find them, oh, well, the Iraqis are liberated. Isn't it a great thing? I wanted to ask, though, what is to prevent other countries from just cutting out the United States and their foreign policy and forming other unions? You see, the European is trying to form a union now similar to what we have here as states. What's to prevent other countries from banding together and saying that we will be more accountable than the United States has been, we'll be more upcoming, and we will conduct our foreign relations amongst ourselves and not continuously bow down to the United States' will on foreign policy?
I
to prevent those countries from doing that.
I want to get to that, Charles, but I'm just curious to know. You say that you agree with Katrina that there was a bill of goods sold on the weapons of mass destruction. Alan was saying, yeah, maybe so, but that's okay because look at the results. Do you agree that the results justify America going in regardless of what the motivation was?
No. You can pick a handful of countries right now and go into and liberate people and say that they're better off now that the United States has gone in there and overthrown their government. But we don't do that. Even here in this country, if the police search your vehicle illegally, whether they find guns, drugs, bombs, whatever, those things are inadmissible because there are procedures you have to follow, things you have to do in order to protect people's rights, country sovereignties, all of these things. You can't go in on a whim and hope you find something, and if you do, great. If you don't, well, that's fine because we fixed this other problem too.
But if I paraphrase what the president says we're dealing with terrorism here, no rules.
When you step on that many people's toes and the backlash is that big, I don't think you can go about it that way. You have to look at it. If people want to look at it as a world community, well, you have to take other countries' opinions in consideration, and you have to look at it, how this is going to affect all aspects, not just terrorism. I'm not worried about Iraqis bombing me. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that they were an immediate threat whatsoever. They never threatened the United States. When they went into Kuwait, they were not threatening the United States. We went in and pushed them out, and Iraq has been there by themselves for 12 years.
Okay, Charles, thanks for that. I'll now jump to the second part of what you're asking about, and that is world opinion and what weight it carries. Bill Emmett, the poll we're talking about, this Pew Global Attitude Project, you know, marks that within the last couple of weeks. In Indonesia, for example, 15% of respondents had a favorable opinion of America. A year ago, it was 60%. Is that something that should be used as a measure for ends justifying the means, the America's place with all the other nations, what Katrina was talking about?
Well, I think it's very worrying. There's no doubt about that. I don't think that one should jump on it and sort of yell in the air and say this just proves that America's done the wrong thing. However, it's too soon to say that. When you use military action, and in particular, you know, in other words, you act in a muscular way, you are pretty likely to make people hate you and hostile to you and afraid of you. And I think America knows that. I think the administration knows that. The question is what they do next. The question is whether or not they show that their aim really is democracy and peace, or whether their aim is another war, having no rules for terrorism, which, by the way, Charles, I think is a terrible thing to say when the administration says it. You must have rules. So I think everything depends on America now proving that it really had good intentions, because a lot of the hostility is about suspicion about American intentions.
And Katrina,
might I just say, there are two and a half things. In terms of polls, yes, we saw the Pew poll, which I think, is a measure of how America has become a source of resentment, not hope in the world. But it's also a measure of anger and resentment toward U.S. policy, Bush administration policy, not toward American values, not toward American democratic style institutions. Much of what is discussed as anti-Americanism is anti-Bushism, is anti-Bush administration. There was also another survey by Amnesty International last week, which shows how the world is less safe because of this preemptive doctrine and allowing governments around the world to use the war against terror to repress human rights in their own countries. Bill raises the question of what the United States does next. The signs are not hopeful in terms of the saber rattling toward Iran, the failure to engage North Korea as much as is possible with economic security guarantees towards
diplomatic resolution. Speculate for me a little bit, Katrina. If the United States sticks with Iraq, if the United States, if the U.S. president digs in on Middle East peace talks, even in the year leading up to an election, isn't some of that balancing out?
Here's the concern about Iraq. What we're seeing so far is on the U.S. side, let's not forget that this national security doctrine, which again, Iraq has to be viewed against the backdrop of that. It was not just about the war against Iraq. The war was the product of a broader policy. This national security doctrine also is about how the United States is going to spread its free market model to the rest of the world. Bill and I will disagree here, but what we're seeing is the privatization and the stripping of Iraq by a government, this U.S. administration, which is more for Halliburton and Bechtel than it is of the people, for the people, by the people of Iraq or the United States.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We invite you to get in on the conversation with our two editors this hour, Katrina Vandenhoevel and Bill Emmett. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. And this hour we have with us Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor of The Nation, and Bill Emmett, editor-in-chief of The Economist magazine. Bill, we were just getting, Katrina was talking about instability in North Korea and Iran and Syria, and you were trying to get in. What was your response there that you wanted to make?
I apologize for interjecting so rudely, but
that's what this is all about.
I felt on two grounds. I wanted to just disagree quickly with Katrina. One was on America's failure to engage, as she said, with North Korea. I just don't think that that's fair. America, in its trilateral meeting with China, has been making big efforts to engage with the government of North Korea, which is a pretty impossible government to engage with. I think that it's actually doing the right thing as far as North Korea is concerned so far, i.e. involving all the neighbors. It's a very multilateral effort. If you have a brilliant solution for solving it, come up with it, but there isn't one, I believe. Secondly, on the privatization and stripping of Iraq, as Katrina was saying, by Halliburton and other people, I just don't understand which planet this accusation comes from. What seems to be happening is a certain amount of American aid money is being used to give contracts to American and other companies, but mainly American companies, to rebuild some aspects of Iraq. This isn't about a debate about the free market system. This is a debate about fixing the oil wells. What happens in the future under a new Iraqi government, whenever that is formed, and I hope it happens soon, will be when the debate about free market systems or central planning or who privatization or whatever should happen. Surely not now.
Well, I would just say very briefly that already the administration and Mr. Bremer in Iraq has made clear that they see the future of Iraq as one of on the model of what they would like to do in the United States. Let's not forget that the more benign power America of the Marshall Plan was the product of a particular America of the New Deal that matched its commitment to political and economic progress in the world with programs for economic security at home. This administration is incapable of nation building in this country I think they will export the Bush administration model of the of economy to Iraq with all the dire consequences of that for a country that needs a mixed market and all kinds of industrial policy planning.
Let's go
back
to...
I would just say that if they manage to succeed in exporting the way the American economy works to Iraq, they'll have done a pretty damn good job.
Let's go back to our calls, 1-800-423-8255. Watertown, Massachusetts. Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael.
Yes, hello. To go back to the original stated topic of the hour, America good or evil, I'd say that there's a question involved, not so much whether we're good or evil, because we're both, but also a question of how unchecked we can be. We're an overwhelmingly strong nation, and to use a terrible metaphor, you have to be much more careful when you're when you're running an 18-wheeler truck than if you're riding a bicycle. And if we verge a little bit in the wrong direction, we can do enormous damage. And really the question is, if we start to go wrong, what power will check us? It goes back a little bit to the 18th century men who set up our government, who knew that men were not angels and we needed competing interests in order to keep us honest or at least in check.
And how do you measure, Michael, where we are right now in the weeks after the war in Iraq, in the week when politicians meet to talk about the possibility of moving towards Middle East peace? How are you seeing it?
I have a mixed opinion. I think that one of the reasons we went into Iraq was that it would be very hard for them to be worse off after we did something than if we did nothing. But the question is, there are things you can get away with one or two times or in hard cases that make for very bad continuous policy.
Could I speak? I think your caller raises a very important question, which is what sort of country the United States wants to be in the 21st century. And I think the genius of the American form of government was the creation of a system of checks and balances. And I think that system is threatened today, both at home and abroad. And that's why I favor a more multipolar international system.
Where's the threat at home to that?
Well, I see it in the threat of the weakening of our Constitution in the name of fighting terrorism, the menacing of civil liberties, the discussion of an endless war and what that means for our institutions at home. And I believe that in pursuit of empire abroad, we are in danger of endangering the republic at home. And this, I think, is a serious issue that many are talking about, and that is not... Well, I'll stop. But...
Shall I come in?
Yeah, I'd like to hear you on that, Bill.
I mean, I agree with very much of what Katrina's just said and what your caller said. I think the issue of how unchecked America is vital. And I do think that on civil liberties in particular, under the pressure of the war on terror or the cloak of the war on terror, a lot of actually rather alarming things have been done in America. And the weakness of a checks and balances system at a time when war makes checks seem inappropriate is being shown, and I absolutely agree with that. I think it'll be vital to have a very open debate, vital for the press, including The Nation, The Economist, The New York Times, everyone, to be part of that debate and to hold this administration to account. And it will be vital that that's done in the 2004 election. I do think that there's some worry about that.
And Katrina, I know it's something that you've been writing a lot about lately, but in a nutshell, why is it that opposition politicians in this country aren't drawing attention to that? Is it because in a low-level permanent war, anything that you say against the administration is still seen as unpatriotic?
Well, there's some signs of life slowly. We see a few Democrats calling even for investigations now into allegations that there were no weapons of mass destruction. But I think following on 9/11, this administration very assiduously, relentlessly, and masterfully used the charges of anti-Americanism, of being unpatriotic, to quash dissent, to quash alternative voices. And we have a media which is already weakened by consolidation, by fear of speaking out against this administration. So the combination of our media and the opposition party's failure to speak forcefully for what is true patriotism, the right to speak out, the importance of holding one's government accountable, all of that combined to make this country quite fearful. I mean, this administration, let's be honest, we were talking about the New Deal. I mean, I hate this administration, what they have to fear is the end of fear itself. And that I believe very strongly.
The end of whose fear? The end of people's
fear? The end of fear. The end of fear that this administration has used fear to suppress civil liberties, to suppress a lively public political debate. And I think that is now, I hope, coming to an end. People are beginning to see through some of the administration's manipulation of fear in this country.
Can I come in quickly?
Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
It's just two things. One is, let's not forget that this is something that a lot of administrations do in wartime, and it's terrible
Absolutely.
When they do it, but the New Deal administration of Franklin Roosevelt is the one that interned all those Japanese during the Second World War outrageously. So people do this, and it's terrible when it's done, but everyone does it. Second, the irony of the difference between Blair and Bush over WMD and so on is that actually in Britain, although there's much more public opinion pressure and press pressure over the absence of WMD, there's a view that constitutionally in Britain we're not very good at holding the government to account and that our investigations may not be as effective as your investigations because of your committee structure and the power of committees in Congress. And a lot of admiration has been expressed this week about the potential investigative powers in Congress of the administration and the intelligence.
Isn't that interesting? Because I've heard people say here that the way that the prime minister's feet are being held to the fire in question time is something that Americans would like to see done in this country.
That's right, but he easily won the vote.
Yeah, the nation has called for an independent investigation because I think the danger of a Republican-controlled Congress holding this investigation is that it will not lead to a really tough inquiry. And you're right, Bill, about Franklin Roosevelt, the detainment, interning of Japanese Americans. The danger today is that this war on terror, and I think of it as a fight because we are going to live with terror for the rest of our time. How we deal with it, how we reduce it, is the question. But the war against terror may mean that we are living in a permanent war footing, and that is dangerous when you have weakened judicial institutions, weakened civil liberties, weakened media.
Let me, if I can, just go back to Michael in Watertown, because Michael, I'd like to hear you on the suggestion that Katrina made a couple of minutes ago that this administration is substantially changing what America will be in the 21st century. Do you see those changes as permanent and substantial?
For me, yes. The terror is a tactic, not an ideology, and terror will always be available for people who have a grudge or beef. A lot of my discontent was summed up in a photograph when Bush was stumping for the tax cut about a month ago. He was speaking at a tank plant or a fighting vehicle plant in Lima, Ohio, and he was speaking only about the tax cut, but he was completely flanked by gun barrels. And I suddenly thought, wait, Trotsky was airbrushed out of this picture because it looked incredibly Soviet, and I'm concerned that we could end up in a situation where we're a nation in decline at home that tries to have its citizens eat national glory in order to make up for the difference.
Thanks for your call, Michael. Bill, let me ask you. We spoke before on this program about your book, 2021 Vision, 20th Century Lessons for the 21st, and I'm wondering if you see something in the 20th century that is in any way instructive in what both Michael and Katrina are talking about in terms of where this nation and this nation's use of power is heading in the 21st.
Well, first of all, thank you, Dick, for mentioning my book. That's very kind of you. But second, and for remembering it, second, I think that there's both encouragement and caution from the 20th century about it. Encouragement in that I think that American power does have a good influence on the world at the very general level of acting as a deterrent to major troublemakers, major movements by major powers that it did really during the Cold War, it did during the Second World War. And I think just the existence of America as the world's greatest power is an important deterrent on other instability. But the second lesson is a more cautionary one, which is that empires, if you build them really, they cause trouble even as you're solving trouble. You solve one problem and you cause another one, and that trying to extend an empire is a mistake. You should actually try to extend the ability to live without an empire. I disagree at the moment in analysis of the Bush administration that it is trying to extend an empire, but I accept that there is a danger that it will do that, partly because it may, through causing new trouble, almost suck itself into creating an empire and find that actually it's ended up in a worse position than it was before. So I don't think it wants an empire. In fact, I think one should really understand recent events in the Middle East, particularly as an attempt to withdraw from that part of the world, to make America no longer being in the firing line there. This is actually disimperialism, not imperialism, but just as the British Empire in the 19th century was partly built by accident, when Britain found itself trapped, in a way, through its own actions in various places, that could happen to America.
Is it, Katrina? Is it already an empire?
Well, if I could just go back to the 20th century, I mean, I think that there is room for optimism in how the United States acted at times in the 20th century in a farsighted fashion in the creation of the UN or in the construction of the Marshall Plan. But I think that, you know, I think Bill, to some extent, is whitewashing, airbrushing a view of American post-war history as the dominant power in that time. I mean, I don't think one can discount the troublemaking and interventions in Guatemala, Iran, Nicaragua, the involvement of
Katrina,
the
Allende. Just got a few seconds.
I think it's too early to tell. I think there are fights within this administration, but the danger is that it wishes to be an unchecked. This administration wants no check, no counterbalance to its power in the world. So it's too early to say, but I think we face an alarming course ahead if this administration remains unchecked by other regional powers, other powers, or by public opinion in this world.
Katrina, thanks for being with us. Katrina van den Heuvel is editor of The Nation. Bill Emmett, thanks again for being with us.
Great pleasure.
Bill is editor-in-chief of The Economist and author of the book that I mentioned, 2021 Vision. Connection listeners, you're welcome to continue the conversation online in the forum section of our website. We are at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.